But again, it's really important for Americans to understand that the decision to cut is a decision that is taken without even debating the alternative that's available, which is to tax the wealthy and the business community. And in case people are asking, gee, what about taxing them? Two little facts to remember. Over the last 30 or 40 years, the relative tax burden on corporations and the rich have dropped across the board in the United States dramatically. So all we would have to do to radically alter the picture is to bring taxes on wealthy people and the corporations back to where they were, not raise them above any historical level, just back to where they were, and the large part of the deficits at the local, state, and federal level would disappear.
Finally, we're seeing some activity on the case of Bradley Manning. You all remember Bradley Manning. He's sitting in some hellhole at Quantico, Virginia, under terrible conditions. He is the young soldier who allegedly turned over some of the material to WikiLeaks. Well, Bradley's been treated badly, and there's been very little attention paid to his case. I am happy to announce that a new advocacy fund has been launched. It's called the Bradley Manning Advocacy Fund.org.
It does not address the separate question of whether the killing of an individual within Yemen's territory is lawful. And the U.S. is really conflating those two questions to say that, you know, they have the authority both under the authorization for the use of military force, but also as a matter of self-defense to do what they're doing.
Yeah, well, that's what's so scary, that they are taking that authority and going around criminal law to execute somebody in Yemen.
Right. I mean, they're going around criminal law, they're going around international law, and claiming unreviewable authority to carry out global assassinations, which is really an escalation of what we saw under the Bush administration and what people found very alarming, which was global detention authority. Here we're talking about global killing authority, really. And whatever the allegations against this particular person, the point is that the authority could reach any U.S. citizen or any suspect that the United States deems to be a threat to, you know, its national security.
Could it reach someone in the United States?
Yeah, that was my question.
It could reach someone in the United States. The full contours of the government's argument would be that the decision to kill is for the executive to determine, and that should be an unreviewable decision, and that it's based on unknown criteria about involvement with terrorism or membership in al-Qaeda and associated groups. So there is no reason why it couldn't reach beyond Yemen to the United States or other countries.
All right. You guys have just come back from Arizona. You were working with the group No More Deaths. And I know you've shared some of your experiences with us prior to the show. But this is really an opportunity and a chance to tell us what happened. What did you see? I know you went on both sides of the border. Just start from why you were there and what you did.
Well, we were living in Patagonia, Arizona, which is near Nogales, Arizona. But the border actually runs right through Nogales. And so we were working on the Mexico side of Nogales, providing basic first aid to those deported who come on buses and are dropped off in Nogales on the Mexico side.
Nogales has a wall right dividing it,
right.
Is that right?
That's right.
How high is that wall?
The wall is actually between 15 and 20 feet high, and it's this corrugated iron, corrugated tin wall that was actually built by the same company contracted that built the wall in Israel-Palestine.
I believe it's called Elbit Private Security.
So you see this wall, and it splits right down the middle of the city. So there's Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico. And obviously, visually, the cities look completely different with crazy winding streets in Mexico and big, broad highways in Arizona. And you can look at this wall from any point of view, but from an environmental point of view, when the monsoons happen in Arizona, which happens for 2 months every year, the flooding comes down, comes from Mexico, and flows towards Arizona, towards the U.S., and gets stopped by the wall. So every year in monsoon season, 6 feet of water gather on the Mexico side, and there's these striking photographs that show both sides of the border, and there's nothing. There's a drought on the Arizona side.
One of the myths that has been propagated in American media is that this revolution or this uprising is entirely about internal domestic issues. Well, there were millions of people in Tahrir Square last Friday, Victory Friday as they called it, and one of their demands was reopening the Rafah crossing. When we were in Cairo for the Gaza Freedom March, our goal was to get through Rafah into Gaza. And we didn't succeed in that because of the Egyptian regime's complicity with the Israeli and American blockade and siege of Gaza. So Rafah is supposed to be open now, but it needs to be reopened permanently.
Dia, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Where are you located?
Right now I'm located in Whitesville, West Virginia, in the Coal River Valley.
And what are you doing there?
For the past year or so, I've been working on campaigns to end mountaintop removal in Appalachia.
What does that mean, mountaintop removal?
So mountaintop removal is an incredibly destructive form of coal mining that uses explosives to blow up the tops of mountains and gets to the coal seams beneath. It's cheaper and more efficient than underground mining. It also employs far fewer miners. So there are far less people employed as miners in Appalachia than there were when mining was primarily underground. And as part of this process, mountaintop removal not only flattens peaks. So far, there's been over 800 miles of peaks that have been flattened, which is an area that, if you stretched it from New York to the San Francisco Bay, would be a quarter mile thick.
This is a pivotal time in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and we understand that you have rushed, actually, to finish Justice on Trial in order to have it screened in Philadelphia with Tiger Hill's competing film. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. When we started working on this film a few years ago, I tried very hard to get interviews with the widow of the police officer who was killed on the night of December 9th, and I was, looking all over to be able to interview her. I think it's important to sort of for the film to be able to show the impetus and the values of the other side of the story, to show what it is that drives that side. And I wanted to get that part of the story. And in doing that, I sort of realized, and I met Tigre Hill in that process, realized that they already had their man. They already had someone who was making a film from their perspective. And in that process, I came to understand Tiger Hill is making a film that's sort of basically a propaganda for the other side. And we've known about each other for the past couple of years, and I realized that the film that's going to be made is going to have to be a film about the Mumia part of the story, and it's going to be another film about the police side, basically. We knew about that, and then finally, Tiger came out, and we saw his trailers for his film and realized that it's going to be a very unfair and propagandistic film of the other side. It's not in any way trying to show what the case is and what it means, what does it say about the larger political picture in this country. It's a film basically arguing the prosecution side.
In the 50s and 60s, for example, which is not ancient history,
for
the
you
top
and me, it's pretty old.
The top income bracket in the United States was 91%. People who earned the most had to take the highest portion, not all of it, the highest portion, say everything over $100,000 or $120,000, and they had to give the government 91 cents out of every dollar over that amount that they earned. Even in the 1970s, it was at the level of 70%. Today, it's at the level of 35%. That's the maximum. So the wealthiest people have seen the most dramatic drop in their income tax. And if we just brought it back to where it was in the 70s, let alone where it was in the 50s and 60s, we would have a vast inflow from the people who could afford it the most, who have done the best over the last 30 years, and who have been the major beneficiaries of the government bailout since this crisis hit. So if ever there was a rational argument to go after those people to be able to get the government to bail us out, which they benefit from, and have them contribute just as much as they used to. And the irony of our politics is the greed and the power of the rich and the corporations is so obvious that they have gotten it not even to be debated. I have to go around the country explaining to people in countless forums that this option exists.